Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning, everyone. Mic'd today, that's good. It's my second time to sit here in this new, beautiful place of practice. So it's lovely to see the changes and gorgeous doors. And there's a quality of already practiced in. I don't know the word for that. There's already sitting that has occurred, and enlightening that has occurred here. You can feel it. So that's lovely. What an honor. My topic today is on simplicity, but before diving into that subject, I want to really honor the folks who have developed, maintained, practiced, and cared for the children here. We just finished our, what annual would that be? 21st annual gathering of children, mandala on the mountain, field, and young. And how many here were visited there or taught there, who are still awake and present? So you all have permission to start leaning over and sleeping, resting, rejuvenating. How many over the years have either had children or have taught in Dharma school here? So, interesting. About half. Before talking about simplicity, I'll just share a little story. Is that a month and a half ago, I got a call from a local church in Eugene, and they said, well, we have this Peace Village camp. 5 days, and every day a spiritual leader comes and talks to the children about their faith, and would you be willing to be the Buddhist teacher for a day for 65 kids, first grade through sixth or seventh grade? And I said, yeah, that sounds great. And then I hung up the phone and I thought, I have absolutely no experience doing something like that. There was a moment of, what was I thinking? But an excitement. And I was pretty sure that they probably didn't want to sit facing a wall for a half an hour and talk about the latest translation of the Heart Sutra. That I knew. But and then the thought occurred to me, aha, I know where to go for such information. And I emailed out, and Coeen volunteered to come down and help me. And we had a really wonderful time. So I had this, after 15 years of practicing here, I've always been aware, and Dharma school has floated around my center, but because of the nature of my practice, I'd never really seen what we're doing. I'd never really seen up close what we're doing. So each of the 65 kids came in small groups, and it was like I was watching a human being grow up from 5 years old until 12 or 13, puberty age, and it was really profound. And we sang a lot of songs. So I told Coeen, the next time I'm on this seat, I'm going to end the talk tonight with just a little song that you all can help me with. But it was quite beautiful. And anyone who thinks that, ideally, that childhood is simple, best look again, right? When I do have some familiarity with the younger ages of 3, 4, and 5-year-olds, preschool. And to watch what a 4-year-old goes through, from arriving to school and leaving. Tears, elation, friendship, rejection, lunch, snack time, sleep time. It's profound. If you really look, it's really profound. So it was a great joy, and I felt so honored to be have a crash course in Dharma school. Coeen was in my office, and we were singing at 9 at night to try to get these. I had an introduction to all these songs, none of which I'd ever heard. Not one of them had I ever heard. And so you're going to really like when I lead one. Not so simple. But those kids just belted it out. So music, and I wondered, where did music fall off the map of learning? No singing in my master's program. So some things awry there. Anyway, I digress. So I do want to honor that, the presence here. It's so important. What I was left with was just a heartfelt love and protective sense of children in the next generation, that we are responsible for them very deeply, and that this practice is a very good medicine. That was a certainty for me. So I am honored, and thank you, Coeen, for teaching me to sing. So the topic of simplicity came up at a couple of different, for a background, and these are my musings, and I invite you to kind of travel along with me to check your own experience about the importance of this topic and where it lives in practice. In my group in Eugene, that's been sitting together for 3 years, like most groups, week after week, you know, month after month, we started to add on more complexity. We started to have tea time, and we started to have more information out in the bulletin board. And I'm really a lover of altars, and so whenever a theme comes up, I'm like, let's make an altar. So the Shakyamuni then turned into having Manjushri and Kanzai on, and the founder's altar, and we needed one for Samantabhadra. So, and all of these had particulars, right? So all of that happened. And so two students came to me and said, Sato, can we talk to you? And then he said, everything's really complicated now. We have so much here. It's too busy, and we have too much to think about. And so we listened and explored that together and actually had a very good outcome. I won't get into that. But one thing that someone said to me was, aren't we about simplicity? Aren't we supposed to be simple? This isn't simple. And I thought to myself, are we about simplicity? Is that true? So I parked that, and that kind of had its course, that event. And then recently there was on our listserv for lay teachers. These are lay teachers all over the country who are posting online about different aspects of their practice. And the dilemma of retirement for teachers, both lay and ordained, being sustained into their retiring ages, after dedicating life to service of teaching and spending much time, is a dilemma in this country. So many lay teachers have, many priests as well, but have outside jobs to support themselves. So life isn't necessarily so simple. There's a lot of time devoted to the teaching, and then there's jobs and family and other commitments. So the online discussion was about that. Different views on that, and someone said, well, it's really important that we role model simplicity for our students. And again, I looked and I said, is that true? That's interesting. And where am I with that? Where am I with that in my life? So that was the beginning of those questions, and I was looking to my own life and to those that I practice with to find a way with this question about what is simplicity. I have a practice in my own life week to week where I have a pretty big ledger paper, and it has different areas of my psychotherapy practice, farm, and my duties for Dharma teaching, and a little corner for personal stuff. And I really enjoy this practice, so I write down my list for the week, and each day there's a new color. I have a little game of Roy G. Biv as I head to the ultraviolet. And each day I kind of reorient myself to what is important. But if anyone were to see this list, it looks like this Pollock painting. So there's arrows and lines and phone numbers and circles. It looks incredibly complex. That's my life. As a lay Dharma teacher, as someone who loves my work as a therapist, love my work as a farmer, and I love teaching and working with people with practice. And so the simple life kind of breaks down when I don't think I role model that in that way that is conventional. It's not really a simple life. And nor do we lead simple lives in this culture, in this time and place. I noticed to arrange, many of you probably have this experience, arrange meeting somebody for lunch takes about 10 emails, one forgotten email, oh, I'll get back to you, searching the web for the right restaurant, and checking and moving people around your calendar. It's incredibly complicated to do something very simple, right? These are our modern lives. And of course, here we are in this beautiful expression, this Soto is coming about because of incredible complexity, right? Not just one simple leader saying, hey, let's do this. A mandala council with different functions, outreach to many, many areas in the community, all coming together to bring this into fruition. So the mandala council, though transparent and open to all, isn't necessarily simple. And yet here we have this manifestation of it. So to back up, I just sort of opened up that question again. I looked up simplicity in Webster's dictionary, And I was expecting something fancy and philosophical, but actually it just says, simplicity is just a condition of something being easy to understand. Something with few parts and uncomplicated. I was like, oh, easy to understand, uncomplicated. And definitions from there go on to talk about something not luxurious, not pretentious, something clear and innocent. So it has a feeling tone to it as it moves from something easy to understand and of few parts. And that wasn't necessarily helpful about my question I was asking, and I looked up complexity, if we are juxtaposing that with simplicity. And complexity is defined as not simple. So I said, well, okay, so I'm on my digging deeper into that. And of course, as I looked, those kind of qualities, something that's a quality or a condition, is really perception-based, right? It's an evaluation. I take my life as a farmer. Many people say to me, ah, I wish for that life. That's a simple life. Right. And I wish that were so. I love when people dream of my life. I enjoy it vicariously, and I want to be that farmer too. It's nice. But after 25 years of farmering, to get one head of lettuce on a table in Eugene, 35 miles away from the farm, takes an amazing amount of complexity, and anything that's not in place will inhibit that from happening. So if the tractor's not running and the irrigation's not running, the apprentices aren't working well together in harmony, the truck breaks down, the seed isn't delivered, you know, the cultivation, the lettuce isn't weeded in a proper way, you know, on and on, right? Incredible. In fact, our meal chant verse, original translation says, we bow to the 72, we honor the 72 labors that brought this food to the table. And so I want to write, I have a little aside project to write that poem, all 72, as a starter. So again, that simplicity aspect breaks down. And on the other hand, we can watch, we can see that on the outside, someone, a virtuoso at something that's simple to them, it's inherent in their body, an artist. We could say, wow, I could do that, but could we? I could paint that painting, but not really. Something that's really refined. But to be fair, I really wanted to honor in my meditation about simplicity that many of us have a deep yearning for it. We use the word, we have a deep yearning for simplicity. Because the modern culture that we live in truly is driven and complicated to a degree that most people I meet are overwhelmed. Most people I know are overwhelmed. They're overbooked, overscheduled, overwhelmed with the amount of demands and choices that they have. And many of us feel, if we take a moment to look, that we're riding this machine, we can't stop. We seem to be locked in, and bringing some consciousness to that is a deep yearning. And so it's not unusual to hear from my clients and others that they really want Walden's Pond, right? It's still a classic. If only I could just get back to nature and to be simple again, to yearn for something that's healing. So it's true that this modern malaise is important that we practice with it. But I'm interested in practicing with it in a way that's not reactive, but it's actually enlightened. And that's why I'm asking this question about simplicity. Certainly Zen practice, we can think of Sesshin, brings us into a simpler relationship to our lives in the moment. And many of us experience a very deep drink of water from meditation to come, to sit, to be simple, to go on retreat, and to just eat, to just walk, to just drink tea, to just meet face to face. Zen has such an offering to our overburdened culture to be refreshed. And of course, if we go back far, the Buddha's own example is one of what we call extremes. Contented with a robe and a bowl, something that shows us that we lack for nothing, that intrinsically we are whole and offers another way of being in the world. But for many of us in this modern culture, that example can seem very far away, right? A robe and a bowl will not get the kids to school and necessarily pass at the jobs that we have to do. So what is it about that example that's important to us? Later on, I love the example of Layman Pang. Probably many of you have heard this story. He and his family one day take all of their possessions and they put it on a raft and they send it out into the middle of the lake and sink it. That's an early back to nature example, right? Because he saw the trap there, the trap in a life of things. Again, I'm looking back in our tradition of where is the guidance for our modern life, how we live a full practice of depth with the complexity, inside the complexity that we have. I do deeply respect and want to honor that there is a movement of voluntary simplicity. And many of the practitioners this last week, this subject has been up, have talked about how meaningful it has been for them in the course of practice to take a conscious look at their lives and to unplug from excessive use of technology, to simplify their travel, to notice where they are busy unnecessarily. And sometimes this comes as a result of practice simply because it rubs off on us as we take up Zen. And sometimes it's a conscious act to look at life and to say, what is it that we truly need? There's a great website, actually, that the folks from that movement, an entire movement and philosophy of way of life, have, and very much aligns with Buddhism and aligns with my farm life, pointing to what real happiness is. That happiness, when we really look, is not connected to bigger, more, better, shinier, and newer. Now it's a response and a reaction to this kind of churning in the culture that I find very useful but incomplete, and I want to talk about why that is. So I after musing after these meditations on different examples of simplicity and these experiences at the Zendo and with the lay Zen teachers, I was still really unsure whether I aspire to simplicity as a guiding principle. And there's something that is problematic about its dualism. When it's taken up as simple is good and complexity is bad. That edge there really invited me to look a little bit more deeply about that. I asked a few people, and you can think of it for your own life, whether when their lives were simplest, were they more fulfilled and happy? And when they were more complicated, again, were they more fulfilled or happy? And the results of that informal survey were mixed. They're certainly mixed for my own life. My life was probably most simple when I was in my young 20s. Little obligations, no money, rented house. I was free to do a lot. I could do anything. Part-time job, friends. But inside, my life was really complicated. It's really complicated to feel lost, unsure of oneself, anxious, seeking belonging somewhere that I couldn't quite find it, have a deep yearning for a practice, not feeling fulfilled. So my experience of life at that time, that was so-called simple on the outside, very little consumption, was not actually simple on the inside. If I look at my life now at 50 and I look at my list and my life has never been so complex on one hand, on an evaluative way. And never know what will come out in the week. But I've never been simpler. My inner experience is things have never been simpler because of what I'm going to propose. So I want to make the case that simplicity and complexity are really value-free qualities. That they're really value-free qualities. That they're neither good nor bad and highly subjective. But what our yearning for simplicity, the part of it that is important from a point of view of resurrection, is I think that we seek the state of mind. We seek the simplicity as a state of mind and a state of being internally. We might call that a state of liberation, and that's not dependent on causes and conditions of our life. It is not dependent on what someone might evaluate as simple or not on the outside. And the question, moving from simple or complex as a value, shifts the question to how these qualities more serve the Dharma. How does simplicity and complexity, as we experience it in our very lives, day to day, serve the Dharma? And how are they the fruits of an awakened life, moment to moment? And what is their place? And I think our own lives tell us this. So when I took a second look at complexity, which has a bad nature as a guide, nature is, if we take a system, a forest system, for instance, what we might call simple in a forest, which would be less parts, is actually not a healthy, vibrant system. A monoculture or a few species are very brittle and subject to enormous quick change. So from an ecological perspective, simplicity is not necessarily a value of nature. The monoculture, a healthy forest, goes to the most complex system possible, what we call diversity. And that diversity is not just a lot of parts, but parts that relate to one another. Very important. So that the mycorrhizal fungus that gives life to the trees and connects their root system, and the oxygen released that feeds the chipmunk and the bird, and the deer droppings that feed the plant, are this system that is an incredible flux. And on one hand, we could say it's complex because it's hard to understand. We can study it, but in any one moment, no one can actually accurately describe it. It is, in and of itself, a whole. And all the parts relate to one another in a healthy system, a healthy, complex system. And I think our lives of practice are really like this, that they are a process of rejoining, that when we add more things onto our life, so we say yes and yes to everything and no to nothing. We say, yes, I'll go to this and I'll take on that. That those parts aren't necessarily relating to the whole, relating to our bodies, our needs of our bodies, the needs of our family, our community. We are disconnected and they don't dialogue. And then we get into inner conflict when our work life is in conflict with our relationship or our parenting or our need for solitude and refreshment. So this is something that we can learn from watching nature. It's not necessarily easy to understand, but a way that we live inside. So when we can look at complexity in our lives as we experience it, we can see, what does it serve? A forest system serves life in a beautiful way. Complexity that disconnects and grates creates tension and anger and delusion and suffering. We can see directly what it serves. And I would suggest that it's that mind of grasping and aversion and confusion. Or we could say the mind of fear and lack that grabs onto and grasps, that creates a complexity that is not serving life, is not serving awakening. And when we look at, on the other hand, so trill-free complexity, we can see that in different places. We look at simplicity, though we might have an ideal of a simple life, of something easy to understand for our own ease. We can look at examples in which simplicity does not serve awakening and does not serve life, but instead causes suffering. And I want to offer this example as a farmer that I'm well aware of, which is in the 1960s, led up to the 1960s, but what we call the Green Revolution, which we know a lot about its consequences now. So in culminating in the 1960s, we, a Western culture, exported developing nations our form of agriculture for the purpose of saving people's lives, for growing more food, and for alleviating hunger. So some claim that a billion lives were served by this action. I don't know where that stat came from, but something that I read. And what we exported was this high production agriculture in which we offered countries the techniques to grow enormous amounts of food on smaller pieces of land. We offered petrochemicals, pesticides, in the form of pesticides and fertilizers, high-yielding varieties, machines, and complex technologies. And those countries adopted that. And what we know now, simple solution to a problem that we saw, hunger, right? And we had a lot of enormous, many, many people got behind this. And there are still some fans of it, though if we look, the consequences of that particular movement are enormous, the negative consequences. And now it's hard to go back. So what was lost was healthy soils, native varieties, the capacity for local communities to determine their futures agriculturally. It did not necessarily in the long run create less hungry people. And there are conditions where the crops were so valuable, people sold them to get the cash, and their own diets remained less than nourishing because that was more beneficial in the short run. So this is a kind of a way in which, and there are probably many examples in the world of this, where a simple solution to a very complex problem causes we fail to look more deeply. And I think of Einstein. I really love this quote by him. He said, "Everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler." I really like that. Everything should be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. And I think he was pointing at something really beautiful there, that we, and I come back, want to bring this back to practice, that we, in practice, move in that direction because we tend to the complicated in our minds that brings about suffering, and we need to renew and refresh in simplicity. Not as a goal, not as a value in and of itself, but for the sake of awakening and service to others. So what I really came about through these meditations was more of really examining for ourselves what our simplicity of mind is. And to me, back into the forest system, it's the mind of stillness and nothing extra that apprehends complexity, that is capable of being in non-opposition to complexity, which we might call awe, or we might call dependent origination, in that our teachings point to the fact that we cannot grasp how we are actually here. We can't. But in a forest system, a cedar tree doesn't worry about an eagle or a deer. They live life in and out through their existence. We've been studying the Mountains and Waters Sutra, and beautiful first line says, "Mountains and waters right now are the actualization of the ancient Buddha way. Each abiding in its own phenomenal expression realizes completeness." I think until I was doing this talk, I didn't realize that last line, "each abiding in its own phenomenal expression realizes completeness." Oh, I come back to practice in that rather than attempting to make our lives look externally simple in the rejection of complexity, that when we are wholeheartedly simple on the inside, whether we live in a monastery or we run a company and have many meetings a day, that the complexity is interconnected with our being and we're able to flow. There's a sense of flow. And if we look at our teachings in Zen, it speaks to that. Like our Orioki ceremony, something, we unfold and unpack something and we bring it back into something simple. So that there, the ebb and flow from simplicity to complexity is really what we're about. And it's that actual dynamic that creates life, that creates a response when we live that from the inside out. That's what actually interests me. So every week on my little list, I have a ritual. I tear that page out, and whatever's on it goes, and I start again. So there's no electronic accumulation. And if something falls off that map, that's what happens. That was not essential. And that's my own practice, to continually go back and distill something down to what's important. So the mind of simplicity asks, what's essential in this moment? Right? Like a cedar tree, what's essential in this moment? I root, I flower. And the rest takes care of itself. That the goal of having something simple to understand is a benefit for the cognitive mind. And though that has its benefits and creates, alleviates stress for people, it may or may not be the thing or the right response at the time. What is essential at this moment? And all of these insights are really given to us through Zazen. Because we come into this practice, the instructions are so simple, right? Breathing, posture, 5 minutes, and you're trained completely in Zen. We sit here, and we become very simple, and we watch the mind of complexity emerge, our entire lives unfold facing the wall. And we learn to negotiate that edge. So, brushing away what's extra. So being simple in the midst of complexity. Now I go back to my own life that I at the moment, at this age, what's called for and right is that my life is complicated. But each day I ask myself, how can I become simpler? What is important about the farm today? What's important at the Zendo today? And at the Zendo, the folks who brought to my attention that we were becoming very complicated, I challenge them to look and notice where busy lives. Where's busy? Is it on the outside or the inside? But I also took some responsibility that I had chosen to add on things without them being cohesive, like a forest. So I decided to take down one altar that wasn't needed now and to look at the way our information was out and to how to see how all the parts related to the whole. That was an important learning. And we met halfway over that mini conflict that's so wonderful in Zendos as we practice together and struggle how things should look. But I don't aspire, although I admire the Japanese art of simplicity, I don't necessarily aspire to that. Buddhism has many expressions. We have the Tibetans walk into a Tibetan temple, very different, right? Incredible visions, but cohesive. It's cohesive because it relates. All the parts relate. So this simplicity on the inside is about seeing what's right in front of us and living this out moment to moment, realizing completeness in the moment and not beating ourselves up so much about whether our life's too complicated or simple, but to find out what's most important. That's my take on this topic. And so I want to end with inviting a simple song. And simple, I learned a lot about simple that day as I watched the kids. They were really lovely. I can remember all their faces. And it was simple because they shared, they weren't as guarded as we become, right? And they shared immediately what was there and their facial expressions. They maybe hadn't learned yet to guard their emotions. So it was refreshing. And simple was there, but not, there was very simplicity in the midst of complexity that I saw that they really were grappling with what we were bringing and had very deep questions about life. In the same way that I see in Gyokoko's working with Shosan with the kids, right? Very important questions. There was one little boy, I remember a Koin read a story, Coconut Monk, right? Is anyone familiar with the Coconut Monk story by Thich Nhat Hanh? A few? So that's a challenging story. When I read it, I thought, wow, this is a lot to read to kids. And yet realizing that they're exposed to such serious issues all the time. We're not hiding anything about what they're inheriting. Thich Nhat Hanh writes about a coconut monk, a monk who opposed the Vietnam War and went to go talk to the president, was thrown in jail, tried to stop the war. And the end of the story is affirmative that mice and cats can get along. So without going into the details, Thich Nhat Hanh wanted to suggest that those of diverse background can indeed get along. So I guess I was expecting somehow that the kids would just go along with this story. I had some questions about it. What will cats eat? But aside from that, for those who know the story, I remember one little boy raised his hand, and he was just off to the left, and this was when the 65 kids were together, and he said, "I don't think that helped." And I can't describe to you how he said it in a way that just pierced my heart. That maybe 6 years old, and I don't know this little boy and his background or story, but I didn't want to give him a nice answer. And I was really stumped at how to respond to him. He said, "I don't think this monk helped." And I just validated that it felt that way for him, that felt that way. But when I left that, after the day went over, I remember this little boy and what he is coming into in the world and how deeply he took in that story and his own koan emerging and spiritual urge emerging for grappling with this world that's difficult and complicated and has pain and suffering. And I think I made a vow to myself after that boy chokes me up, something touched me, to live out this practice really well for him and for others. Because the veering into the despair and hopelessness was right on the edge there, right on the edge. And that deepened my commitment. And I wish one of those minor regrettable moments of which I wish I had a better answer for him. I wish I had a better answer for him. So I think I appreciate that he shared like that and will carry that forward. So it was a really, really educational day. So I learned a lot about Dharma school. The whole week before I read the whole manual. I said, "Wow, we do all this, it's amazing." And again, Koen gave me a crash course in the songs. I can't sing, so that's okay. Apparently, you can have a wide range of tune for these songs. And the kids helped a lot because they just shouted out, right? And Koen knew the songs, so that was great. And I'm sorry, there's not a formula. I didn't know how to get them out of my head. So for weeks after, every moment of quiet in my head, the songs were going through. So I thought, I wondered why. Why I'd never been taught these songs. So I'm going to teach you one. So we'll do it. It's just the refrain because I don't remember the other lyrics. And it relates to the theme today of simplicity. It has four lines. And I'll sing it once through. And then we can do it together three times. And then maybe sing Maha Prajna Paramita three times out after. Okay? I thought of doing it around, but that sounded really complicated. I've never led anyone in singing before. It's a beautiful song. I'll give the words first. Small doings, great being, tiny things, small doing, marvelous moment, Maha Prajna Paramita. Got that?
Yes. You've got quite a few people in here, but no.
You think so? No one taught me. Okay, thank you. Go on. Small doings, great being, tiny things. Small doing, marvelous moment, Maha Prajna Paramita. Small doings, great beings, tiny things, small doings, marvelous moment, Maha Prajna Paramita. Small doings, great beings, great beings, tiny things, small doings, marvelous moment, Maha.
Mahaprajnaparamita, Mahaprajnaparamita.
Thank you for indulging my fantasy. What an excellent job. Where's the Dharma camp for adults? Are we making that next? Yeah?
It's called Sinshin.
Come on down to the farm. Might be some singing around the campfire this year. Open, the floor is open if we have time, or moving on.
Wow, what a meaty talk for me. I've spent a lot of my life, especially in recent years, feeling bad or guilty about how complicated my life has been historically. And as of a couple of years ago, I had an all-consuming job, the kind that you go to sleep with and you wake up with, and I was helping caring for a dying father in San Antonio across the country, and had an apartment and a dog, and sat on two community boards, just all this crazy stuff, like your flowchart, right? And then I was practicing here and balancing all of that stuff. So today, I live here.
The simple life.
The simple life, right. And I'm a postulant, right?
Yeah.
So I like set all that stuff down, and I come into this place, which is far from simple. In fact, it's kind of crazy nuts, this place. You know, it's got councils and committees and projects, and it's developing 14 acres, and it's in prisons, and it takes kids to camp, and every time I look up, there's a new thing happening, and now there's a young adult program, and I don't even know what that is, and it just goes on and on and on. And this last week, everybody was away at camp, and I was so happy because life here was so simple, and I loved it. And people who were involved in camp were saying, oh, camp is over, I'm so sad. And I wanted to say, oh, I'm so sad too, but it's because you're coming back. So it's fascinating to be in this place and to be so aware how not simple in one way it is. It's no more simple than it was kind of out there. It's fascinating.
Thank you. The one thing about driving into a simpler place again is to look at what brings you here, or brings anyone here to practice as a postulant and to take on vows, and to develop that theme. Beautiful. But to escape to the monastery has information about that. Thank you for revealing the truth of that. Walden Pond. Yeah. Angie.
It's funny you should use a Dharma school song to illustrate. I was just thinking the other day, they often pop into my head, and they're the only songs I can sing after these years. A song popped into my head that we don't actually get to sing very often, but I keep advocating we do, Dharma Rain. And it's based on a parable in the Lotus Sutra, that the Dharma rain falls on everything equally, and each takes what it needs accordingly, all the plants of different sizes and so on. Dharma rain falls everywhere with a single flavor of liberation. So as that was in my head, I was thinking of the young adult program sprouting up, and I realized this complex mandala that we have, our organization, has gone from just a few big blossoms to a more complex, many-blossomed things growing that are interconnected, that So we have all these teams, you know, that are working on making this place happen. And here's one blossoming into existence. Mm-hmm. And now we have to nurture it, too. And that's how I guess I see the complexity and the simplicity. The simplicity is that we are operating from this core of the Dharma of emptiness. And the complexity is how it blossoms.
Mm-hmm. I think of my home temple here as a really wonderful ecosystem that serves. In the Genjo Koan, Dogen says about birds and fish, says when their need is large, their field is large. When their need is small, their field is small. Thus, each of them covers its entire realm. So that there isn't a one, there cannot be at this time and age a one version of how we should live life as monastically or in a complex way, that Dharma rain falls everywhere, here, cities, simple life, not simple life. So thank you. Thank you for the song.
I wondered if you could elaborate on a point in your talk that I heard. Mm-hmm. And that resonated with me was about cohesiveness. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For me, like when I heard that, mm-hmm. It seems like cohesiveness exists in what would seem simple externally, mm-hmm. or in what seems complex externally. Mm-hmm. And it feels like an aspiration towards cohesiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Instead of having my life be more simple or having my life be more complex. Mm-hmm. And as a point to touch in on, mm-hmm. to ask myself, you know, mm-hmm. if there's dissatisfaction, it seems like that's a point that could be a question.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is this cohesive?
Mm-hmm.
The job, the home temple, that, you know, this, that, and the other thing, is it all relating? So would you mind maybe elaborating a little more on cohesiveness in our lives? You had used the forest
mm-hmm.
as the example, but I wondered if you could take that out into...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think you did that a little, Mia, already. I agree. It's not a word we use a lot that is kind of jazzy, but cohesion... Again, where all the parts are in dialogue with one another. No parts, we can see it in family systems, right? Where there's no coalitions and blocking and cut-off relationships, that everyone is in dialogue with each other and in groups. And if there's hierarchy, it's appropriate hierarchy. But I like to go to the simplest place for cohesion, which is in the body.
Yes.
And we're cohesive internally, so when our minds grasp on more, that's a part of us that isn't listening necessarily to the body that says, I'm exhausted and I need to rest. So our bodies have systems that need to relate to one another. Our need for sleep, our need for play and joy, our need to be connected. All of our senses, right? Sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. So when we are not in our heads, And the feedback loops are happening, we're much more able to respond from an ecosystem of the body. And then we connect outward from there. Right? So all I know of this practice, and my therapy practice as well, is about reconnection, about reconnecting. The body's a good place to start. And then we look at our lives, our relationships, our work, our commitments. Where do they align with a deeper intention? And where do they really, where are the ideas of shoulds and shouldn'ts? So, thank you. Find that out. Report back what that looks like. Different for everybody. And you're right, cohesion can be in simple and complex. It is not just in complexity. Thank you.
Thank you for your talk, Sato. One of the things I was thinking about that was starting to bother me was about you started talking about flow, and I think mm-hmm. heard of flow states,
mm-hmm.
which you were talking about like virtuosos, people who are really skillful, they can get into a kind of a flow state, and it's simple in your mind, but you can do complex things, and you can do things that are very powerful and effective. And but then I started thinking, well, I guess that's a form of simplicity that can be powerful. But then I thought about, well, there were guys involved in that Green Revolution you were talking about who were doing very complex and intellectually challenging work that I'm sure was very stimulating, and they were getting into those flow states probably in the course of doing it. But a lot of things went wrong, as you alluded to. And I thought, well, yeah, there's a problem there. And then it occurred to me that maybe part of the simplicity that we are cultivating here is uncluttering our minds so that we can observe the world and ourselves. And maybe if we are able to unclutter our minds enough, then we will be receptive and aware and notice when those unintended side effects are occurring.
There's a that's a tough example that I used. There's a couple of elements there that I think we're missing, and we practice. One is humility, that awakening is a real collective activity. And one person's flow state is a part of a bigger puzzle. So I don't know what would have happened in the Green Revolution time had people been more connected to, in their particular roles, to the actual ground floor activity and the consequences. We're all learning. Humility is a part where we take our place, but we also don't know. And that allows us to continue to have the airwaves, the feedback loops open to others around us in the world. So we inherit the collective karma of that time. So, yeah. But we're much more likely to act as a group and individually when we can be simple and to listen and be receptive rather than to come forward with our idea of what should happen. So I agree with you on that. Thank you.
When I think about simplicity or feel simple in my life, oftentimes that's when I have set some kind of goal and just go for it. I'm a translator, so oftentimes there's a deadline that I have to meet, and that gives me a simplicity because I don't have to think much about anything else. And so that's a form of simplicity, but I'm noticing that now that I don't do much of translation work, then I can't do that because I don't have that kind of demand right now. And then what happens is every little things kind of bother me. It's like, so I just noticed that the simplicity I had with my work actually was maybe not quite a wholesome one. That it felt good oftentimes because I was so focused and I could forget about everything else. And can you sort of talk about this type of simplicity that can happen on when individually or collectively we set a goal and see that other goal, you know, we have to meet this goal, and then we get simple. But then, like a green thing, revolution that tend to kind of makes us forget. Like, probably you talk about cohesiveness. It's like not quite cohesive. It's just because we're focused on something that we forget about everything else. So how do you navigate that?
That's a good question. I identify with that. As a farmer, it's a really direct a lot of energy, especially in the morning hours. And I really enjoyed for many years that part of being able to channel the chi into activity. But over the years, in my own experience, I saw that I did that at the expense of some kindness to others at the farm. to the people in my employ and have regrettable actions at that time. So riveting an attention somewhere to the expense of receptivity can bring temporary ease, right? It was easy, but something's missing. And so I think we're constantly coming back to the simple in Zazen to look at our deeper intention, is that what does it serve? So if something's organized around grasping an outcome, then we question that. We've turned off our receptivity. To hold a direction rather than grasping an outcome allows us to continue the connection. And to notice where we find refreshment in the narrowing of consciousness and what it's serving. But it's true, our minds are built that way, because we are anxious when we're trying to hold too many things. That's true of our psychology, right? I have to do this, that, the other thing. We're divided from ourselves. But Zen practice and the Zazen brings us to something different, where the focused attention is on our truest heart and where we're moving from in the world. And I think it's a lifelong, many lifetimes, and I'm continuing to refine that. So we see now what's now. Now that you know that, what's now?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Are we at time, I assume? One more? Zara?
Thanks for your talk, and I want to say I'm glad you got to spend time with kids, because it is wonderful, and that's one of my favorite ways of having a simple day and having a really great day. I live with a five-year-old, and I just love it when I get to take care of him, because his mom is just on the go. She's 35. She's trying to start a business, and she's trying to have a garden and make organic food and blah, 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 and she just has this list. Her to-do list just goes on and on. And mine is like, feed Odin, play with Odin, go to the park, and it's great. And so I just recommend hanging out with little kids and reading Coconut Monk and interpreting what it means to all of us, and invite everybody to come to Dharma Camp, because it is for us too. It's Dharma Camp. It's not just for the kids in our Sangha, but for all of us. And my kids are grown, and I get to go play with everybody else's kids when I'm there, and it's awesome. And we had more hands in the kitchen this time, so I got to go out and like hang out with some of the kids and just listen to their conversations and watch them teach each other how to play guitar or sing a song or talk about something that happened at home with their mom. Oh, yeah, my mom's crazy, too. You know, it's great. And so I recommend that you come, even if it's for a couple days, and help in the kitchen or be a gopher or do something, because it's wonderful. I invite everybody to come. It's really amazing, transformative practice for everybody.
Oh, how perfect, Sara. Thank you. Wanted to convey that even more, of what it means to have that as our central dharma here, to learn from children, to be graced, to take care of children. And it's a beautiful thing. I'll close with an exchange of the Layman Pang family, which is they had a daughter, a young daughter, 7, 8 years old. Well, she grows up over time, but she was always the one who had the enlightened comeback when her father and mother were exchanging. So I'll try to remember it. The father says one day, as he's studying the sutras, difficult, difficult, difficult. It's like scattering sesame seeds over a big tree, trying to cover a tree with sesame seeds. And then the mother says, easy, easy, easy. It's just like waking up in the morning and stepping onto the floor out of the bed. And of course, the daughter is the wise one, and she says, neither easy nor difficult. The 10,000 grasses all speak the truth of the masters. Right? And I think that's true here, that if we listen, that we learn so much and are blessed to have that full circle. So I aspire to that, Sara. And we'll put that on my list. may it come true. And thank you very deeply from the bottom of my heart to all of you who have cultivated this amazing program and rescued me in this endeavor with the kids. When they were leaving, what did it say, Cohen? You said someone came up to you and said, I like the songs. Yeah. Will you come back? So maybe this will be an ongoing affair. They will teach me some more. So, thank you.